Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two-parter today. We'll hear from the political economist Güney Ishikara on the deepening authoritarianism in Turkey. And then the political strategist Kenan Korth will explain how a DSA-linked progressive slate took over the leadership of the Nevada State Democratic Party. First, Turkey. A couple of weeks ago, Turkish President Recep Erdogan, who's been becoming more and more authoritarian during his 18 years in power, moved to ban the leftist People's Democratic Party, known by its Turkish initials as the HDP. It is a coalition of left-wing forces that is demonized as pro-Kurdish, the kiss of death in establishment Turkish circles. Erdogan's party, the Justice and Development Party, known by its initials AKP, saw an end to its one-party rule in 2015, thanks in no small part to the HDP. The AKP now rules in alliance with, among other right-wing forces, a fascist party known as the MHP. What's going on in Erdogan's Turkey? An important node in what's come to be known as the Nationalist International, made up of countries like Bolsonaro's Brazil, Modi's India, Orban's Hungary, and until January 20th, Trump's U.S. Here to explain is Güney Ishikara, and my apologies for mangling the Turkish, a professor in the Liberal Studies program at NYU. He's the co-author of a recent article in Jacobin on the topic. Here's Güney Ishikara. So let's just start with what Erdogan did, moving to ban the pro-Kurdish HDP. What is the HDP and what is Erdogan trying to do to it and why?
So the HDP is actually an alliance. It consists of various parties and organizations. Of course, the main component is the Kurdish Freedom Movement and its political representation, which was before the HDP called the BDP, but then it basically resolved itself and dissolved itself into the HDP. And then, other than the Kurdish movement, there are various socialist organizations there, representatives of the ecological movement, women's movement, and LGBTQ rights movement. It was first established in 2013 or 14, and that was a time during which many things were changing in Turkish politics, because in 2013 the Gezi uprising took place in the west of the country. Actually, it then spilled over to the entire country, and that significantly destabilized the hegemony of the AKP, the one-party rule of the AKP, which was then 11 years old. In 2015, it was the biggest election success of HDP. It hit 13%. That was its share during the 2015 elections, and that was the first time that the AKP lost its single-party rule since it took power in 2002. That election was in June, and right after that, the country found itself literally in a bloodbath during the summer of 2015. And the elections, there were snap elections in November again, and the political atmosphere, the political climate changed drastically. There was a massive pressure and oppression against the HDP. People were being detained. And, you know, top state attorneys started to take it to the constitutional courts. The media campaigns were all hampered. The HDP was not able to go to the streets. And that wave of oppression that started back in 2015 persisted until today. And HDP is basically, we can say, it is an alliance of the oppressed identities, as well as some factions of the working classes in Turkey. The national question has a big role here. So I cannot say that the HDP represents the entire working class. That is not the case, not the chauvinistic elements of it. But it is, in fact, an alliance, a front of the oppressed identities and factions of the working class.
Certainly the Turkish state has a longstanding fight with the Kurds, but opposition to the Kurds often stands in for a broader opposition to the left and popular power, doesn't it?
It is. It is. I mean, this has been the tactics that the Turkish state has been employing since its foundation. I mean, there has been always internal enemies. Yes, the Kurdish question has been one of the bedrocks It's foundational for the Turkish Republic, but the same goes also for the Armenians, for the non-Muslim and non-Turkic elements in the society. But the Kurdish issue has been massive in the, especially since 1984, when basically an armed struggle was started by the Kurdistan Workers' Party. And yes, it is a divide and conquer strategy. The Turkish state has always used the chauvinistic campaigns, our fight against separationists, and so on and so forth, as means of oppressing also the working classes and the left in the country. But whenever any government, not only the AKP government, but whenever any government found itself in a significant difficulty, you always observe that the war against the PKK reached new heights, and there was a state of emergency in society, and basically the government and the police and the judiciary takes hold of everything and oppresses all freedoms and all movements. That of course has implications for strikes and everything, because that is the time for everyone to unite for the national interest, you know, the typical the story that we know from also other parts of the world.
How secure is Erdogan's power now? He's losing popularity. Is he making other moves to secure his status?
This is a little bit tricky. It would be a stretch to say he's losing power, because he has been able to grasp the power in his hands. But it is, I think, the fact that he and his party, the AKP, has been going through a hegemonic crisis since 2013, and especially since 2015. So that had several elements. There are several causes for that. One of them was the establishment of an autonomous Kurdish region in northeastern Syria, which gained some sort of power and started to establish an order, which the Turkish state grasped as a threat to itself. Secondly, the Gezi uprising in 2013. And thirdly, the changing economic outlook. The Turkish economy has its own problems, domestic problems, but it doesn't only have to do with domestic policy making and lack of expertise or, you know, bad politics on part of the AKP. Of course, they have been in power almost for 20 years, and of course, they bear the responsibility for many things, but at the same time, the Turkish capitalism is tightly integrated, incorporated into global capitalism. And for example, when the first tapering signs came from the Federal Reserve in 2013, Turkey was one of the economies that was hit most severely by that. And a round of economic crisis, waves of economic crisis, hit Turkey since then. So that was another element, another important element there. And since 2015, as I mentioned, that was the year when the AKP for the first time lost its a single-party rule. There was a coup attempt, a failed coup attempt in 2016, which was orchestrated by, well, it is contested, but I do think that the Gülen clique, the Gülen movement, the Gülen community was behind it as part of the broader alliance, of course. But since that coup attempt, basically the government interpreted any sign of oppositional voice as linking with terrorism, trying to overthrow the government, and all kinds of measures have been taken, you know, the police, judiciary, state attorneys, even social media is closely watched these days, and there's a very heavy pressure in all aspects, in all realms of everyday life. And I do think that that is because the AKP is losing its popularity. Well, that is captured by many polls indicating that the AKP, along with its ally, the fascist MHP, the Nationalist Movement Party, they cannot hit 50%, which is what they need to make Erdogan be elected again as president. This is also an important issue because people pretend, I see the commentators, especially in the West, focusing closely on the elections, but we must say clearly that there has been no elections in Turkey since 2015 that were organized according to even the minimum bourgeois democratic standards. The oppositional parties lacked their rights to campaign. Before any election, you see every day dozens, hundreds of members of HDP being detained and arrested. The HDP has not appeared in any mainstream media for 6 years, I think. Every night you see a bunch of commentators meeting up and discussing the HDP, but no representative of the HDP whatsoever. And the same is slowly also taking place, like for other parties, for other oppositional parties. They can barely find any coverage in the mainstream media, which is almost totally monopolized by the AKP these days. And the social media is closely being watched. Any critical voice can immediately be interpreted by state attorneys as assault to the president, offending the president, and you can find yourself behind the bars all of a sudden. So we should not also pretend that there are democratic, fair elections in Turkey. That's not happening. So I don't want to say that if there's an election, AKP will be losing it. That's very difficult to say because they have had like five or six elections since 2016 like this. And they all, in the referendum, the presidential referendum in 2017, when the system was changed from a parliamentary democracy to a presidential system, I mean, the AKP lost that. More than 2 million votes, which were not legitimate, were counted legitimate. That was against the constitution, but it did happen, and the system changed. So we should be very careful about statements when it comes to elections. But yes, I think Erdogan's popular power, his popularity is eroding, and he's doing anything to boost it these days. Yeah.
What is his political base?
Well, his political base is a mixture of, the right, the conservatives in Turkey have always had more or less one half of the popular vote in Turkey. But it had a fragmented structure until the AKP united it around 2002. Since then, it has always, its vote share has always been somewhere between 35% and, 47-50%. And the base is conservative, the petty bourgeoisie, small and medium enterprises strongly support the AKP. They believe that they flourished with AKP. Also, a good share of the working class did also support the AKP, has been supporting the AKP as well. Mobilizations based on Turkish nationalism, mobilizations based on the West or external powers trying to undermine the rise of Turkey have been successful so far. Many people did buy that argument. And of course, also many factions of the bourgeoisie also support Erdogan and his regime, despite the fact that sometimes they make certain statements complaining about the cultural policies or their concerns about education and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, the last 20 years were golden years for them, and they explicitly stated this in many occasions. They said, I mean, we never were able to make such high profits in the past.
Is there any kind of bourgeois opposition, big bourgeois opposition?
Yes, well, there is one that is brewing. In 2019, in the municipal elections, the AKP lost, their alliance lost the most important cities. Istanbul, for the first time since 1994, by the way, and the capital city, Ankara, and other major cities were lost. We call this the restorationist opposition. It is mainly the CHP, Republican People's Party, which was Kemal Atatürk's party, which founded Turkey, the Turkish Republic. And other than that, there is a clique, which was part of the MHP in the past, which is led by Meral Akşener, who herself is also another extreme right-wing, if not directly fascist person. That is another party there. And now there are also two other parties. The former prime minister under Erdogan, Ahmet Davutoğlu, founded a party. And the former minister of economics, Ali Babacan, who is very popular in the West, actually, who is always praised for his economic policies, especially before 2013 and 2014. He also founded a party. And all these four parties, we see that they're constantly trying to find a common ground, trying to form a so-called democratic front. But what we see actually is that whenever it comes to important issues, such as, the national question, the rights of the Kurdish people, when it comes to the HDP, or whenever the government initiates a new military attack against the PKK, we see that all these restorationist elements basically line up behind the government and fully support it. And that's part of the reason why the AKP is still so strong, actually.
I'm speaking with the political economist, Guni Ishikara. The economy has been a mess for many years, foreign debt problems, currency crises, and then Erdogan keeps firing the central bank governors. What's the fundamental problem there with the Turkish economy, and what kind of shape is it in right now?
Many people say that Erdogan doesn't have an economic policy. He's just trying to save the day. Well, he's trying to save the day, but I think he does have, he and his, you know, his party does have an economic policy, and that is based on navigating in the midst of a structural crisis. I think the economic crises that Turkey has been going through are rather structural. The Turkish economy heavily relies on imports. Imports of raw materials, energy, intermediate goods, machines and equipment, which basically gives rise to chronic current account deficits, which is financed then by external borrowing and rising debt. And in 2009, actually, it was the AKP itself which lifted constraints on foreign borrowing to basically boost the credit-driven expansion. And, well, during those years, it was not a big problem because, you know, abundance of funds, abundance of dollars. But starting with 2013, again, when tapering first came into the picture, which indicated the end of cheap liquidity, the depreciation of the lira became a big problem because the very structure of the Turkish economy, which is based on external borrowing and rising debt, well, these days I think the total external debt of the public and private sectors is some 60% of GDP, and 65% of that belongs to the private sector.
And of course that's not in the domestic currency, that's in foreign currency.
Yes, yes, this is external debt. Most of it is in dollars, and the rest is in euros and other currencies. Today, like the short-term external debt, again, in other currencies, with a remaining maturity less than a year, is $190 billion. The Turkish GDP in 2020 was $717 billion. So it is alarming for the AKP to see that the Turkish lira is depreciating so strongly, and that has been the case in 2013. And then in 2018, during that summer, the Turkish lira depreciated by some 50% against the dollar. During the past few days, again, some up to 10%. We saw, there's a high volatility, but the Turkish lira is rapidly, again, losing its value vis-a-vis the dollar. Now, we see that at times, Erdogan, the AKP, and his central bankers, I say his central bankers because he keeps changing them, they desperately raise the interest rate because, as I said, the Turkish economy is part and parcel of the global economy, and the currency depreciation brings the economy to the brink of collapse, and in order to attract foreign capital flows, they have to raise this rate. Well, Erdogan never publicly approves or appropriates this position, both on religious grounds, and also he has like this big conspiracy, and I saw this in the news again today, like in all mainstream media you see in Turkey right now. People close to the government, economists close to the government come up and say this is an attack against our economy. This is the so-called the interest lobby, they call it. Erdogan calls this the interest lobby, trying to undermine the Turkish economy because they are afraid of Turkey rising. But still, they have to rise it time and again. But at other times, they cut the interest rate because, well, both production and consumption is heavily credit-driven. During the past 20 years, under the AKP, the labor share declined by some 15% in Turkey, and real wages have been stagnant. As the currency is depreciating, we also observe a serious problem of inflation, and people basically rely on consumer credits, on mortgage credits, and so does the productive sector. And that means they cannot persistently also keep increasing the rates because that is going to destroy their base, their supporters, the small and medium enterprises, the consumers, who are going through difficult times. Now, the previous finance minister, who was Erdogan's son-in-law, by the way, Berat Albayrak, he decided to boost domestic demand at all costs. That was relatively unorthodox, but then he ended up experiencing historic losses in the value of the Turkish lira, and that at some point led him to leave his position via Instagram, by the way. And the government was silent for a couple of days. They didn't say any word on this. But yeah, I mean, last Friday, once again, the government, Erdogan, basically, through a presidential decree, appointed a new chair to the central bank, the previous one, Naci Ağbal. He gained some confidence of the international markets. He did raise the interest rate immediately as the first thing when he took office. And I think he was appointed in November, so he could only enjoy his seat for 4.5 months. Now, there's another person, again, a very close person to Erdogan, and also he has his PhD advisor is the same one as Al-Bayrak, so we can safely assume that, again, now it is the time for the changing gears and once again pulling down the interest rate and trying to boost domestic demand and help the small and medium enterprises breathe a little bit.
The situation that Turkish economy is in, the weak domestic manufacturing capacity, heavy reliance on imports, very high foreign debts, recurrent currency crises, which you respond to by raising interest rates, but then that becomes intolerable for the domestic economy, so then you have to loosen again, and then you get back in this reflation treadmill. It sounds like this is just not sustainable and mounting towards some sort of major crisis. I mean, is there a way out of this situation without some kind of major changes?
I don't think so, but here is what is interesting. The AKP came into power in 2002, and that was actually in response to the most severe crisis, economic crisis, of the Turkish Republic in 2000 and 2001. And there was, you know, a big structural adjustment program in place, and they applied, they basically appropriated it until 2007, 2008. And, well, I mean, nowadays, for example, the arguments coming from the restorationist opposition, they kind of praise the early years of the AKP as a story of success. You know, they say, we have to turn back to that orthodoxy. You know, we have to have good relationships with the IMF, and we basically have to adopt the neoliberal orthodoxy if we want to survive these days, they say. Well, what they miss, of course, is what's happening today is just a continuation, or if not an immediate result, of the IMF program, of the structural adjustment program, a massive wave of privatizations, laying off public workers, real wages were stagnant for many years after that, higher unemployment rates, and so on and so forth. Well, I don't see a way out of this without a major structural change. And a major structural change for me is not retreating to the neoliberal orthodoxy, coming up with a new agreement with the IMF and just applying it. It is, again, as I said, a structural issue. It has to do with the way the Turkish economy is integrated into the global capitalist order. And not only Turkey is experiencing such problems, many other so-called developing or emerging market economies are going through similar phases. And I think it is very difficult for them to survive these crises without a major change. But what the quality of that major change would be is controversial. I mean, not controversial for me. I do think that a popular government, you know, slowly taking steps in the direction of disintegrating Turkey from the global capitalist order is the only major way out of this crisis, the only long-term way out of this crisis, I would say. Other than that, we will just keep finding ourselves at the same position over and over again.
Erdogan and Trump had a fairly good relationship. Has the transition to Biden had any effect on Turkey? And how has the Biden administration been treating these power grabs by Erdogan?
Well, for some time, it was a mystery. For a very long time, there were reports that Biden and Erdogan didn't call each other yet. So people were expecting a major shift in the stance of the United States against Turkey, especially in terms of its foreign policies, and given the fact that Turkey has bought these S-400s from Russia, which is not, of course, compatible with being a NATO member, which is one of the major points of tension between the United States and Turkey. But it turned out that a couple of weeks ago, I mean, there was a report in Reuters, and it said that in a meeting, Angela Merkel and Biden agreed that there's no need for sanctions on Turkey at this point, which is like giving a green light to Turkey to basically keep what it has been doing. That legitimation gave Erdogan some strength in terms of basically pushing. I mean, when we say the state attorneys took it to the constitutional court to close the HDP, it basically means that Erdogan told them to do so. Erdogan is the one who appoints 12 out of 15 members of the constitutional court. In many, many different contexts, we've seen basically they literally take orders from Erdogan. I mean, he comes up every Tuesday in the weekly meetings of his party, and he says, well, this person, I'm not sure if he has been jailed for correct reasons, and then immediately after that you see the person being released. I mean, there's no law whatsoever left in Turkey. And I think Erdogan took it as a green light, the fact that the European Union and the Biden administration didn't see any need for sanctions. I don't know what we can expect in the medium run, especially, again, Erdogan has been flirting with Putin, with Russia, as a policy, as a strategy of diversification of its tactics to gain some leverage against maybe the West, we can say so. It has adopted a very aggressive, militarily aggressive stance in the Middle East over the past 5-6 years. It was heavily involved in Syria, and it is now attacking constantly the Kurdish regions, both in Syria and in Iraq. It was involved in the problem between Azerbaijan and Armenia. So it is acting as a local imperial power, as a local imperialist, as a sub-imperialist. Well, that has been always allowed also by the United States, but I think the question of the relationship between Erdogan and Putin will be decisive how Biden is going to react to Erdogan.
That was Guni Shikata, a professor of the Liberal Studies program at NYU and co-author of an article on Turkey on the Jacobin magazine website. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after musical break, speaking of divide and conquer. We divide it up all the way. We got states and states, cities and their neighborhoods, and more. Stop, 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 stop. Their trust is divided by walls, open in latitude. In longitude, we'll need to find out what's in this bag. Why? There's lots of area code and 9 digit zip codes. Just bring it to a raincoat. Hard to reach out, things not hold. Well, I miss the new computers. Wake up the global village. Get 18 UPI murders to tell everybody. News, news. Some of Divide and Conquer by Husker Du, one of the greatest songs of the 1980s. In early March, a slate of progressive candidates led by Judith Whitmer was elected to lead the Nevada Democratic Party. This came with substantial assistance from the Democratic Socialists of America. Like many on the left these days, Whitmer was drawn into politics via the 2016 Bernie Sanders campaign. In recent years, DSA has had a complicated relationship with the Democratic Party. Many of the organization's leaders view the party as just a ballot line. Given the hostility of U.S. electoral law to third parties, sometimes the easiest thing for a socialist to do is run as a Dem, even if you aren't really one. In this case, the local DSA moved to take over the state party, a throwback to when Michael Harrington was running the show and dreaming of transforming the party from within. Keenan Korth is a progressive political consultant who serves as a campaign manager for the Whitmer slate. Here he is to analyze what happened. Let's start with Nevada's politics. Biden carried the state, but not by a large margin. What's the nature of politics in Nevada?
Politics in Nevada is very fascinating. I think there's a lot of reasons why it's been such fertile territory for progressive organizing. And in part, that's because the Democratic Party here and its allies in particular among organized labor have really transformed the political landscape here over the last couple of decades. The last decade and a half in particular, Nevada has gone blue in presidential elections. We've elected 2 Democratic senators, our first Democratic governor in 20 years. And that was a long time in the making. The alliance between the Democratic Party and labor, Culinary Union in particular. This is a working class town. Although we're struggling with cost of living and houselessness here, like every other major city, it's still a place where working people can have a decent life. Together with labor, the party has built an incredible mobilization machine. When you look into the details of that, we despite Biden carrying the state, we have not reached that high water mark that we had here in 2008 when Obama carried the state by 12 points. It's been narrower and narrower margins overall.
What do you attribute that to?
From our perspective, on the left, one of the things we see is some missed opportunities to grow the party and organize in between cycles. So while there's been an incredible success in mobilizing the Democratic base around elections, nonpartisan registration is still going up. It's a smaller and smaller base. And so one of the things Chair Whitmer and the slate ran on and we've been organizing towards is a model that builds on the successes and strengthens the party in between those cycles, grows our membership. And we believe we can do that by talking to people about the issues that matter most in their lives, the material concerns that they have as working class people, and the progressive movement's solutions to those problems, I think, really resonate with folks.
The dominant figure in the party is still Harry Reid, right?
No, that's correct.
What's the source of his power? I mean, now he's not in office anymore. Is it just his personal charm? And what does he do with that power?
He's an extraordinarily effective politician, and he's responsible for this strong alliance between organized labor here in Nevada, in Las Vegas in particular, and the Democratic Party. He's recruited countless of our elected officials into public service, and even on Senator Sanders' campaign, some of the most senior officials, as well as, you know, many of our senior staff here in Nevada, spent time working for Senator Reid, as well as others in that network. He's been very intentional about the operation they built here.
Now let's talk about the event itself. I guess the cartoon summary is that insurgents slate with the support of DSA takes over state party, displaces old guard. Old guard runs off with all the money. So could you flesh that out some from that cartoon version?
The cartoon version is based in reality. In many ways, those are the broad strokes of what happened. But it's been a long time coming, and it's been a concerted year-long effort in particular around these recent officer elections, made immediately possible by the outcome of the Nevada caucus and the landslide victory that we had organized towards on behalf of Senator Sanders. But even that victory in the caucus itself is attributable to the foundation that had been built painstakingly over the last 4 years since the 2016 cycle. Progressives, leftists, Sanders supporters here in Nevada learned a lot from that cycle, but it was a much different campaign. And the major realization that I had and many of my comrades that I have been organizing with, that I met at that time and have been organizing with ever since, we recognize that part of our failure to make these kinds of gains post 2016 and 17 within the party were due to a lack of intentional and permanent organizing structure being left behind in the wake of that cycle. So we endeavored to start creating that infrastructure ahead of 2020, first in hopes that Senator Sanders would run again, or that whoever that progressive standard bearer for that wing of the party might be would have the ability not just to win the caucus, but to win in a landslide. And I think many of us here in Nevada viewed the path to the 2020 nomination as running through Nevada. And obviously that didn't quite turn out to be the case. But nonetheless, we developed a really intentional and robust inside-outside strategy, if you will, with, you know, our organizing in DSA, as well as Left Caucus, which is a chartered Democratic caucus in the Clark County Democratic Party. It was started in 2018 by myself and now Chair Judith Whitmer, among others. We felt that just organizing outside of the party, while critical to building independent power, would not yield the kind of results we were looking for as we wanted to change not just any old Democratic Party for the better, but one of the strongest state parties in the country, one of the most well-known and well-respected and accomplished state parties in the country, we saw opportunities for additional improvements to be made and additional progress to be made. That Inside-Outside Coalition, DSA, Left Caucus, these were kind of the core of the grassroots political coalition leading up to the caucus that I think gave Senator Sanders that foundation to win with the landslide that he had. And then they were the key organizations, and Chair Whitmer in particular was critical after the campaign wrapped in keeping those delegates organized through the what we call the caucus to convention process. So from that precinct level caucus to the county level caucus to the state level caucus convention, and then ultimately to the DNC, where our, you know, Judith Whitmer was notably elected as an elector for Nevada in the Electoral College, as well as our statewide DNC delegation chair, because of the strength and unity that we had as a Sanders delegation. And all of that set up the gains that we've made in these leadership elections most recently. But starting back last summer was when some of these statewide leadership positions at large those elections were held, and we performed really well. So we knew that this was a possibility for a long time.
One of the things that's interesting about this is that most DSA people these days who think about these things tend to look to the Democratic Party as a ballot line to be used, but not something they necessarily want to get deeply involved in. They've moved away from the old Michael Harrington hope of taking over the Democratic Party or transforming it from within. You guys have gotten deeply into it. What's the thinking? Do you think you can change this party? I mean, you know, a lot of leftists are going to tell you right away, graveyard of social movements and all that. So what about the relation with the Democratic Party?
You know, it's always been a pragmatic relationship. Myself, many that we organize with, Chair Whitmer, we are all lifelong Democrats. I have been a registered Democrat in Nevada since I was 17 and caucused in 2008 at first for Dennis Kucinich, and then as the sole caucus goer in my precinct for the congressman, and then after realignment for President Obama. But many of us, I think, have been radicalized over the years. Many of us have always been very far left, have not always been thrilled about the options that the Democratic Party has presented. But I think there is across the board a recognition that despite however many similarities there may be between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, that there are some serious differences, and that when Republicans win, it has real consequences. And so it's not out of any just pure, unadulterated love for the party. It's motivated by a very clear-eyed idea of what's at stake, especially for working people. Nevada was a Republican state for a very, very long time, and we still have a lot of work to do because of that to create a better and fairer and more equal society. It's always been a pragmatic formation. It's not always fun to be engaging in these central committee meetings, especially before the kind of virtual turn with COVID. It was, you had to travel all across the state for these quarterly meetings to attend in person. They were often really long and drawn out, and very often very little would happen, but you had to stay engaged to maintain a seat at the table. And I know on the left, there are all these sorts of strategies, and I'm familiar with some of the terms like dirty break or clean break, or there's a new term, the dirty stay. I know what these terms are. I don't really know what they all mean, and I have never, and my comrades here who I've been organizing with have never really gotten too into the weeds with any of that, because it's always been very obvious to us that we did have an opportunity to make change if we kept organizing in this very pragmatic way. And we've not had time to really think about how our strategy might fit into, you know, one category or another. I think it's always been a both and or an all of the above approach to our organizing. And there are a lot of quirks to the way the Nevada Democratic Party is structured and operates, and in particular, the way that our caucuses here play a role in that. Obviously, that's going away. And so a lot of people ask us how they can do what we've done.
That was my next question, yes.
Yeah. I think that these sorts of things are possible. I don't know that the parameters are always going to be different. And I think what we've had success here with is just being hyper cognizant of the context that we're organizing and what those specific parameters are for Nevada. So I certainly think it's possible for folks to do this in other states and other places, as long as there's that really careful and specific analysis of how you navigate the systems, how the party operates, who are the players and the power dynamics. And for us here, we've assessed that and laid out, again, like a four-year plan to get to this point and stayed very focused.
I'm speaking with the progressive political strategist, Keenan Korth. What do you plan to do with this newfound power?
There's a lot of debate about what we've accomplished here. To go backwards a little bit to your question, the question that plagues the left of, can the Democratic Party be taken over or transformed? At the very surface level, I think we've at least started to answer that here, that, yeah, it can be. The bigger question that we are focused on now is whether or not it's worth it. You know, a lot of folks, both supporters of ours, comrades on the left, as well as many of our detractors, have tried to downplay these efforts in that, you know, operating the state party is not necessarily a source of power. It's rather an administrative burden. And I think the opportunity that we have here to build power for the left is, you know, and in part answer that question as to whether or not this kind of engagement with the Democratic Party is worth it, is really the opportunity to show that we can run a state party as well, if not better, than those who came before us. That when we seek to do all of the things that the Nevada Democratic Party has succeeded in, when we seek to replicate those, that we've got an additional value add as a mass grassroots movement of boots on the ground. And I think that's where we seek to show that value add in an organizing model where we're not just mobilizing during GOTV, but we're growing the party, growing engagement in the political process, growing support for progressive and left-wing policies in between cycles, so that when we mobilize every cycle, we are winning by larger and larger margins. I think that's one of the opportunities. Another is to show that we can have the resources, we can raise the resources that the Democratic Party needs to succeed. I think there's a lot of skepticism about the left's ability to do that. And we're, you know, in the weeds right now of figuring out how to transform Senator Sanders' novel in 2016, small dollar fundraising operation. You know, over the last few cycles, I think there's been a lot of efforts to figure out how to translate that at lower campaign levels for whether it's running for Congress or local office or things like that. But, you know, it's kind of a different situation with a state party. It's a large operation. It needs to raise and move and allocate and spend a lot more resources. You know, I believe in the 2019-2020 cycle, $13 million came through the Democratic Party here in Nevada. But if you know, look at the numbers more closely, the Nevada Democrats only directly raised, I think it was $1 or $2 million of that total sum. The rest was passed through from other committees, party committees, and other committees. So we're looking to see how we can engage the enthusiasm and capitalize on this moment. I think there's also a lot of outrage because of some of those broad strokes narratives of the establishment kind of taking their ball and going home, draining the bank accounts ahead of these elections when they saw the writing on the wall. But, you know, I can tell you we're already seeing an extraordinary response. And I think we're in a position here in Nevada to be able to raise the kind of money and run a really well-organized, coordinated campaign to ensure that Democrats win up and down the ballot. I think there are going to be a lot of opportunities in the 2022 cycle here in Nevada for us to elevate more progressive left-wing and socialist candidates in key positions. But we're also aware that as the left, whether we want to build a mass working class party independent of the Democratic Party, or whether we want to endeavor to turn the Democratic Party, at least in part, into that kind of mass working class party, we have to have mass buy-in from voters. And the fact is that, at least here in Nevada, working class voters, the vast majority of them people of color, of immigrant background, many of them in workforces that are organized and politically powerful, you're not going to build that trust as the left and as socialists with them if you cannot demonstrate that you can win up and down the ballot and elect Democrats, because that's who they vote for, by and large. Certainly not everyone, but we want to increase that, especially as we work to kind of change what this party looks like. We're taking, you know, our duty very seriously to run this party and, you know, not concede a single seat to Republicans, because like Republicans in every state, they're getting more and more extreme here in Nevada. We've had a lot of moderate Republicans in office, but those are not the Republicans that they are nominating in general elections these days. And so we know that we have to continue winning elections for Democrats, but we think that we can do it in a slightly different way, where we're relying on fewer corporate donors, that we're relying less on mining industry and gaming industry and developer money, and more so on tens of thousands of small dollar contributions from, you know, regular working people here in Nevada and across the country. Again, the response has been very, I think, encouraging just in the past couple weeks here. So we're really excited about the possibility to show people, especially our detractors, that we're not the caricatures, the unserious, naive, passionate caricatures, or worse, the kind of villains that so many Democrats, and at least in Nevada, view us as reflexively, that we're out to destroy the party explicitly, like from the inside. We get those accusations a lot. We've really just done what they've told us to do all along, which is that if you don't like the way things are going or the way things are run, get involved and change them. So that's what we've done here.
Oh, and finally, there's an analysis that the Democratic Party isn't really much of a structure. It's a name, but the idea that there's some kind of Democratic establishment that runs a whole lot of things, that there's this big machine that dominates the party, you know, from top to bottom, that's just wrong. And that, in fact, the thing is much more flexible, almost structureless, and therefore open to transformation. How do you feel about that question?
It can be difficult to understand how the Democratic Party works. And this is, you know, it's been an, you know, I'll admit this has been quite an education for myself and the folks here on the ground over the past few weeks. But I think it's a little bit of both. Obviously, we discussed the kind of machine element in Democratic politics that exists here in Nevada. There certainly is a very well organized network of political operatives and elected officials and power brokers and fundraisers and strategists that, at least until March 6th, were using the Democratic Party as a vehicle for that machine here in Nevada. But it's also what you said, like it's a network. Really, there is no national Democratic Party. State parties are really the highest level of kind of an organized party in the traditional sense, where there are rank and file members and there's, you know, varying levels of internal democracy. And I think this has been a trend in particular among the Democratic Party, especially compared to the Republican Party. And it was Democratic presidents in the mid 20th century who, once their campaigns were over and began their presidencies or their presidencies ended, they reinvested that organizing capacity, or they started reinvesting that organizing capacity into external organizations. I mean, we see that now, most recently with first Obama for America and then Organizing for America, that there wasn't a reinvestment in the party. And so it's not this one massive, impenetrable, cohesive, nationwide party with, you know, or a machine or establishment. It is at the highest level, 50 different statewide parties. They all operate differently. They all have different parameters. The Democrats we elect from one state to another are oftentimes very different. And there are parties like in Minnesota, where there has always been an explicit labor component in their state party. And so I think it's a little bit of both. And I think state parties are incredibly important as a line of defense against the Republican Party and against fascism in this country, and the forms that that might take. If you break it down to that level and you understand and analyze the specific context state by state and you know, county by county, there are going to be places that the left can exploit and organize and capitalize on and be able to take control of the levers and operate the party. We have not won power yet. I think we have won a new opportunity to build power. And I think that's what we intend to do by showing that we can win and that we will continue to make advances, not just for the Democratic Party broadly in Nevada, but for socialists and progressives within the party.
That was Keenan Korth, a Nevada-based political strategist. I'm still skeptical about getting too involved with the Democratic Party, but we'll see what happens there. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the title track from Lana Del Rey's new album, Chemtrails Over the Country Club. Till next week, bye.
I'm on the run with you, my sweet love. There's nothing wrong contemplating God under the chemtrails over the country club. Wearing our jewels in the swimming pool, me and my sister just playing it cool under the chemtrails over the country club. Dig out your turquoise and all of your jewels. Go to the market, the kids swimming pools. Baby, what's your sign? My moon's in love.